The following lecture is under copyright by Reformation Christian Ministries and is for your personal use only. It is not to be copied or otherwise distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. Contact information will be provided at the end of this lecture.
This is Lecture 4 of Modern Church. We turn now to the latter part of the 17th century in England, which we call the Great Secularization in England, because things changed rather rapidly. The Anglicans came back in power after the Commonwealth, and the King Charles II took over, and Puritan influence waned tremendously. That's kind of an outline of what we're going to be looking at. We talked about some of the progress that was made intellectually, scientifically, and so on in our last lecture, and we see that these factors have more and more to do with the lives of people, particularly with respect to taking their minds off of religion and making government rather than religious truth or the church the center of people's lives or that which led their lives. And so we can say, I think, that the latter half of the 17th century in England was very much like the latter half of the 20th century in the United States. Christianity was taking a smaller part in people's lives. It was becoming less of a factor in their decisions, in the way that they lived their lives, and so on. Politics was becoming a standard for people's actions. Since there was a great deal of political power given to the people, perhaps not by modern standards, but certainly by previous standards in England, political work and the work of the government became more important in people's everyday lives, something that they could at least have some say in, although that say was very indirect through Parliament and the rulership of Cromwell. Well, as we look at the last days of the Commonwealth, which are really the last days of Oliver Cromwell, because he died in 1658, we see some of the things that happened. First of all, Cromwell co-opted the holy or bare bones, as it was called, Parliament. A Parliament was elected that didn't seem to want to really have a decent part in governing England. It was a Parliament in which sectarian religious leaders had been elected. There was a great deal of arguing and not much that meant political sense. And so Cromwell finally decided that that didn't work, and he co-opted the Parliament. He set it aside. Two more parliaments were elected, but they didn't do much in the way of positive, useful work for England either. They couldn't decide on anything because they were divided among so many different sectarian ideas among the various sects that had grown up in England alongside the Anglican Church, which by this time was pretty well taken over by the Presbyterians and the Congregationalist Calvinists, and yet they couldn't really muster a majority either in Parliament. And finally, Cromwell takes over as dictator. His title was Lord Protector. He did not want to take the title of king or anything like that. He thought that was wrong. And the Church of England was continued under his protection, but it didn't have bishops, it didn't have various kinds of things. Parishes continued with independently elected pastors. Each one of the parishes could elect its own pastor, and so there were some very positive things. However, of course, preachers are human beings too, and in an unsettled situation like this, it's not surprising that a lot of charlatans, that is, false teachers, got into the ministry. And so a board of triers, that's spelled T-R-Y-E-R-S, triers, people who tried or tested the ministers, was established in London to try to make sure that there was some quality in the preachers and in what they did as they went about their business. And the board of triers, of course, was a Puritan board. It required that there be no festivals of the church year. This was considered to be a Romish invention. The Book of Common Prayer, of course, was outlawed. And the Board of Triers sought to see that people did their jobs effectively and conscientiously. Well, while things were moving along with some regularity or some administrative ability during the life of Cromwell, he couldn't live forever. And so in 1658, Cromwell died. Now, the general of the parliamentary army, a man by the name of Monk, held most of the power. Cromwell's son replaced him as Lord Protector, but he didn't have the political experience or the force of will to be able to rule a nation, And so it didn't take long for him to lose power. And actually, Monk, the general of the army, held most of the power. Now, it didn't take long for the forces of Anglicanism, or of what we would call the High Church movement, to start to come back into power under General Monk. The Anglicans and some of the Presbyterians were in favor of what Monk was doing. Monk began to deal with Charles II, who, as we will remember, was in exile, but was still alive and had tried to foment some kind of situation favorable to himself. Well, the Parliament tried once more early in 1660, 2 years after Cromwell's death, to establish a Presbyterian church in Anglicanism. In other words, to make the Anglican church into a Presbyterian church, one that was ruled by elders and ministers who would have assemblies, and there would be an orderly administration of the church. But once more, Parliament failed to pass this kind of a motion, and the situation continued to degenerate in the church. Finally, in May of 1660, Monk made an agreement with Charles II to restore the Stuarts to the throne. And so Charles and the family of the Stuarts, Charles II, I should say, came back into power. Now, there was a great deal of negotiation, and the Puritans were involved in that negotiation, the Puritan Congregationalists and the Puritan Presbyterians. And what they wanted was equal representation in the Parliament and in the government. And that was promised to them. However, Charles II was not interested in keeping his promises. He was interested in coming back into power and reestablishing the monarchy in the old form. In other words, with the divine right of kings. Richard Baxter, the Puritan pastor, who is famous today for a number of books that he wrote, and one that is used very often in teaching pastoral work, drew up a revised form of worship service, but it was ignored in the subsequent administration of the church. So the Puritans were pretty much locked out, even though they thought that they had an agreement from Charles and from the other governors. That just didn't work out. And so the Parliament actually was more and more taken over by the High Church Anglicans. Lord Hyde, the Earl of Clarendon, became Chancellor of the government, and he was very strong in establishing High Church Anglicanism over the Church of England. He, in fact, wrote up what is called the Clarendon Code, which is a group of acts requiring the cooperation of the church officers with the government and with the High Church Anglican Church. For example, municipal officers had to be Anglicans. There was no room for people who were not part of the Anglican Church, which was, as I said, being taken over by the bishops of the various areas and the High Church Anglicans. Not only that, none of the Puritan articles of faith or of church government were accepted in the Clarendon Code. In other words, the church was simply locked out of, or I should say the Puritans were locked out of the church. As things went along, finally in 1664, a few years later, the Parliament passed the Conventicle Act. And that was a very strong and repressive act for the Puritans and other people who were now dissenters from the Church of England. It required that no meetings of five or more people could be held without being under the leadership of the rector of a local parish of the Church of England. And so that required that no one could lead a worship service that include more than five people unless they were a priest of the Anglican Church. Well, that pretty well shut down the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians and other kinds of Puritans and Separatists from even having worship services. And, of course, that was very repressive. There was no freedom of religion or freedom of speech in a situation like that. The Conventicle Act was followed by the 5 Mile Act. Clergy could not live within 5 miles of an earlier preaching place unless they were subject to the king and subject to the Anglican Church. So it not only said that you couldn't have meetings, but a clergyman who had served perhaps as a Puritan, Congregationalist or Presbyterian clergyman in one of the parishes couldn't live within 5 miles of that place unless they submitted to the government of the king and of the Anglican Church. And this, of course, wasn't not surprisingly, brought forth a great deal of persecution. This is the act under which, for example, John Bunyan was imprisoned because he preached in his old parish where he had been the pastor during the Commonwealth, and he was arrested and put in prison. And, of course, while there, he wrote Pilgrim's Progress. But there was a great deal of persecution. There were also some improvements in the rights of people. For example, under the new government, a jury could not be fined for its verdict. Now, that seems like a very strange idea to us, that a jury would decide a case, and then because the government was not happy with the way they decided the case, they would be fined. Well, there was an improvement under Charles II. A jury could not be fined for its verdict. In 1679, Parliament passed a resolution requiring a habeas corpus, and that is that there had to be some evidence of a crime for somebody to be accused of a crime. At the same time, there were a great many people were persecuted and put in prison simply because they dissented from the Anglican Church or they did not submit to the rule of Charles II. And there was a great deal of difference in prison. Some were very, very bad. People were simply left to rot without any care. If their friends didn't bring them food, they simply starved to death. Others were not so bad. There was quite a separation in how people of royal blood, noblemen, and people with money were treated when they were put in prison compared to poor people. And so the situation was not very good under Charles II. Well, of course, Charles didn't last forever either. And that brings us up to a section that we call a Dutch king for England, because that's what happened. One of the Dutch kings came over and became the king of England. And that's a very, very interesting story. The revolution under which this happened is called the Glorious Revolution, and it happened this way. In 1685, Charles II died, and he was replaced by his brother, James II, who now became the king of England. Now, you'll remember I had described Charles II's religion as being basically Roman Catholic without submission to the Pope. He believed that the Church of England was the best expression and the best group that was carrying on Roman Catholic teaching or historic Roman Catholicism. But James II, his brother, was a committed Roman Catholic. He was not committed to the Church of England unless the Church of England would submit back to the Church of Rome. Now, this was abhorrent to a great many people in England, to the vast majority of people in England. And so while Charles was able to maintain perhaps what we would think of as a Romanizing influence, while he was the king of England, his brother James was known to be a Roman Catholic, and that simply was not tolerated. It was tolerated, I should say, for 2 or 3 years until he produced a son. And by that time, the people had had enough of James II, and they also were very much afraid that if he continued to rule, of course, his son would grow up and become the king of England, and they would be taken back to Roman Catholicism. And while there were many who were anti-Puritan, anti-Presbyterian, and anti-Congregationalist among the leaders of the Church of England, there were very, very few who wanted to go back to Rome. And so what happened is that the noblemen, the leaders of England, with the agreement of many of the leaders of the Church of England, as well as those Puritans who were not in prison, began to plot the overthrow of James II. And it happened that James II had a daughter by the name of Mary, who had been married to William of Orange. Now, he was William II of Orange, but he was William III of England when he came to be the king of England. So it's a little bit confusing. But he had married the daughter of James II, whose name was Mary. And he, by the way, was the son also of an English princess by the name of Mary. So this can get kind of confusing. But William II of Orange was married to a daughter of James II by his first wife. And William was the States General of Holland, what went in Holland for the king. Although in Holland that was quite a different kind of a rulership. You did not have in Holland the divine right of kings. The king of Holland was actually elected by the Parliament of Holland, which was called the Estates of Holland, or the States of Holland. That, by the way, is where we in the United States get the term states for our provinces. The provinces of the United States which would be called provinces in Holland or France or in another country like Canada, are called states here, because the states of Holland were the representatives in a senate, and that senate elected the king. And William had been elected as a very young man. In fact, before he reached the age at which he was supposed to be elected, several months before that, Louis the 14th of France invaded Holland, and the Dutch needed a general, and this young man, barely out of his boyhood, was elected. His father had died when he was 6 weeks old, and now when he was 19 years old, before his 20th birthday, he was elected, and he turned out to be a fearless general. He has an interesting story, and I would recommend that you study William II of Holland, because he is, of course, the grandson of William I, the Silent, who freed Holland from the Roman Catholic domination under the Spanish, and now this William II becomes the state's general when he's just a young man, and he had been raised by two very fine people. One of the old Dutch Reformed pastors, who was a hard rock Calvinist, very Reformed, and also by William Huygens, H-U-Y-G-E-N-S, who was the inventor of the reflecting telescope and a great scientist. And they taught this young boy not only of a very fine Reformed faith — he was a tremendously strong Reformed believer, one of the few kings, true kings, that you and I can expect to meet in heaven — and he was also a tremendous military strategist. His boyhood games under the leadership of these two men — they took over his education when he was 5 years old, by the way — his boyhood games were military strategy games. And so he led the Dutch against the French, and actually threw the French out of Holland or the Netherlands, even though he was much outnumbered, and Louis the 14th had a great deal of money, and Holland was a small country. It wasn't really very rich, although it was doing quite well because of the great navy that it had. But in any case, William was a man, by the time he was 25 years old, of a great deal of experience, and a man who had established himself as a great king among the kings of Europe. Well, what happened is that the nobles of England invited William to invade England and to throw James II off the throne, and that's exactly what he did. He took the Dutch army, sailed across the Channel. The Dutch fleet was almost blown down into the hands of the English fleet, which was standing off of London, and then the wind changed, and just at the nick of time, they were blown back up to to the North Sea coast of England, where they landed in friendly territory. And as they came off the ship, William said to his English, his wife's English cousin, "What do you think of predestination now?" So he saw in this the hand of God. Well, it didn't take long for his army to gather a lot of English armies in connection with it, and it wasn't difficult for them actually to throw James II off the throne. He fled to France, where he lived in Roman Catholic France, in the court of Louis the 14th. But William and Mary then came to England. By the way, William and Mary College in the United States was established with a grant from William and Mary when they were upon the thrones of England. And they were established in the German Reformed Church, the Reformed Church of which the present lecturer is a pastor. But the point is that William and Mary came to England in the Glorious Revolution. The Parliament met and negotiated with them. And that was a very interesting period in English history because it changed the monarchy. Now, the Parliament of England wanted William and Mary to operate pretty much as Elizabeth II and Philip do today. In other words, Elizabeth is the queen, but Philip is not the king. But Mary had become a Protestant and had learned a great deal from the Bible about the relationship of husbands and wives in marriage, and she refused to become the queen unless William would become the king, because she said a woman must be in submission to her husband, and she said, "There's no way I can be the queen unless my husband is actually the king." Well, the Parliament came back and said, okay, as long as you're alive, William can be the king. But when you die, we want one of your children to become the heirs to the throne, even if William is still alive. Well, Mary refused that too. And finally, the Parliament acquiesced and allowed William to become the king of England, in with everything that that means, and Mary as the queen. And of course, what's sad about the whole story is that Mary and William never did have any children, and she died at a fairly young age, and William didn't last too much longer. I believe he was 42, at least he was in his early 40s, when his horse stumbled and threw him, and he never recovered. He became a sickly man after that and died in a couple of years. So this didn't last a long time, this reign of William and Mary. In fact, they are, in a sense, unsung heroes of England. They were used by God to keep England from being taken over by the Roman Catholic Church again. And yet, if you go to Westminster Abbey, where they are both buried, only a very few knowledgeable people know where William and Mary are buried, because they don't have a great tomb. In fact, each one of them has is a piece of slate in the floor in the back of the tomb of Mary, Queen of Scots. One of the earlier queens had a tremendous chapel built and a great sarcophagus is there, a tremendously large coffin for her body. And you walk into that room and there's hardly room. It's probably about, the room is probably about 20 by 30 feet. This chapel, and most of it is taken up by this immense sarcophagus of Mary, Queen of Scots. And in the back of that room, behind a little fence, there are some lesser princes, some children who never grew up of the kings and queens of England are buried there. And there, there are a couple of slates in the floor that have William and Mary. So they are not recognized very much as having anything good to do with England. I was very happy when Prince Charles, the present Prince of Wales, and Diana named their first child William. I thought maybe there would be some understanding of the importance of William in the history of England. But, of course, Charles and Diana have become one of the scandals of the 20th century, when two people are spoiled brats and they grow up without any Christianity and without any law of God in their hearts. It's pretty hard for them to maintain a marriage, even if they are two of the most materially blessed people in the world. Well, William introduced toleration into England. The Church of England remained established. It received tithes from people, and yet it also was not the only church that was allowed to operate. William recognized that the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians, and various other kinds of independents should be tolerated. And so the persecution ended with the coming of William, and worship was open to any who subscribed to the 39 articles, minus 3.5 articles on that rejected Socinianism and Roman Catholicism. So actually even Roman Catholics and non-Trinitarians, because Socinianism is anti-Trinitarianism, could worship in England. And so all of the dissenting groups during the reign of William were allowed to worship freely. William reigned from about 1687 until about 1702 or 3, and so England was given a reprieve, and the church was given a reprieve too, in the sense that those who wanted to worship according to their consciences could worship in England. Now, one of the unfortunate things is that the Archbishop of Canterbury and a number of followers of high church, which means more Roman Catholic ideas in the Church of England, refused to swear allegiance to William as king, because, of course, he was a Dutchman. And they formed a non-juring church, that is, non-swearers, those who would not swear to obey the king as long as he was William. And much of Anglican piety went into this church. In other words, a lot of serious Christians went into this church. They were, as we could expect, naturally unhappy with a foreign king on the throne of England. Nevertheless, I believe that this was one of the things that saved England from a great deal of trouble and improved its government tremendously. Much of what is in American government that comes from England comes by way of William's and Mary's ideas in in their negotiations with Parliament in establishing their rulership in England. For example, the post of president in the United States is almost identical to the post of States General or the King of Holland. Now, he's elected periodically, whereas the King of Holland was elected for life, generally. There was not a term of office, but he was elected by the Parliament in Holland, and his main job was to be the commander-in-chief of the army and to be the one who represented the government of Holland in its negotiations with other countries and that kind of thing. One of the requirements of the Constitution is that the executive branch of government will be that which takes care of international affairs. That comes directly from Holland, and there are some other things more detailed that could be mentioned. Well, the Glorious Revolution then helped to mitigate the effects of the reestablishment of the Stuarts, who had a lot of Catholics in their family, as the kings of England. After William died, as I said, Mary died earlier, and after William died, then the Stuarts came back on the throne, but the situation in England had changed so that quite a group of movement of different ideas could have at least some freedom of worship and so on in England. And I'd like to look now at that portion of our outline, which looks at the new movements which grew up during the latter half of the 17th century in England, new movements among the church. First of all, we want to talk about the Congregationalists. And they, of course, are a continuation of the Independents, those who wanted to be independent of the Church of England. They did not believe in a state church. They believed that there should be a church independent of the state. And, of course, I think we would agree with them today that an established church is not the proper kind of church because it is generally ruled by the government in an unhealthy way, and that's an unhealthy form of Christianity which is doomed to abuse sooner or later by those who are in authority in it. Well, by 1667, there was an independent congregation in London. One of the leaders of the independents was Robert Brown, who wrote a treatise which proclaimed that the church should be independent of the state, that there should be no fixed bands of unity in the church, that the church should be separate and pure from the world, and that ordination should be in the hands of the congregation, not in the hands of bishops or people who had some kind of a physical laying on of hands connection all the way back to the Apostle Peter. That was not what he thought should be the case. And so the principles of independentism or congregationalism were written down by Robert Brown about this time. Now, it's interesting that Brown himself got tired of these ideas and went back to become an Anglican rector in 1686, pardon me, about 20 years after congregational churches were started and founded in London. Nevertheless, Brown's ideas continued to circulate, and a lot of people took them up, and a lot of churches took them up. And so this is really the beginning of a congregational church in England, which is quite different, we need to point out, from the Anabaptist congregationalism or independentism. This is a lot more principled. It has a lot more biblical ideas. It's not just a reaction against the authority of an hierarchical church as you had in the Church of England, although, of course, you can't escape that completely either. Now, another couple of men who are very important are Greenwood and Barrow. They added the idea of government of the local church by a board of elders. They were not too successful personally because both of them were arrested and hung for sedition. The idea that the local church was capable of ruling itself, or that men could be elected by the congregation to rule the local church, something, of course, that Reformed and Presbyterian churches have held before this time even, and have successfully done for many, many years, was seen as such a dangerous idea by the authorities in England in these days after the restoration of the Stuarts to the throne that these men ended up dead because what they did was considered to be treason against the church and the state. Another man by the name of Henry Jacob advocated reform within the church of a congregational kind of idea. He was what we would call a non-separatist congregationalist. He did not want to separate from the Church of England, but he pushed the idea of a local church supported and governed by itself, but supported by the state within parish boundaries set by the state. So the state could have some power with respect to setting parish boundaries, but then the church would govern and support itself within that. And the support of the church, however, would not come from simply free will gifts of the people, but the support of the church would come from the government of the area. And that was an idea that was tried out in London way back in 1616. Jacob, by the way, Henry Jacob was a graduate of Oxford University, and he tried out, or he advocated this kind of reform for the Church of England. But of course, that didn't hold a lot of value in the eyes of the state or the eyes of the church, the authorities in his time either. And there's another man, John Robinson, who in about 1609 took a whole congregation to the Netherlands because of his ideas of a church separated from the state. Now, there was mutual dissatisfaction, I would say, between these Anglicans or these separatist Anglican Congregationalists and the Dutch when he got to Holland, because in Holland you had at this time a state church, and it, while it was organized differently and less hierarchically and not with bishops but with classes and synods, however, they were somewhat under the control of the government too, and classes and especially synods were only held when the government wanted them to be held. You'll remember that the Synod of Dort was called by the States General of Holland, by the Parliament of Holland, what we would call the Senate. And so John Robinson's ideas were not did not find a very good basis in Holland either, in the Netherlands, we should call it, because Holland is actually just one province of the country of the Netherlands then and today. So Robinson looked for another place to land, and he found one in Virginia. The idea was that they could go to the New World and establish themselves as a separatist, congregationalist Anglican church, in other words, holding to the 39 articles of as their confession. And we should say at this point that the 39 articles, which were written up during the reign of Edward VI during the Reformation time in England, are really quite reformed in their doctrine, in their teaching of salvation and so on. They often are thought of probably not, their contents are not very well understood by most people in the Reformed movement today, but there are Anglicans who are of a Reformed doctrinal stripe who still remain Anglicans, and in the Anglican Church there is a vast range of people. Now, some of us in the Reformed movement in the United States today would think it is quite inconsistent for a Reformed person to stay in the Anglican Church, and yet Philip Edgecombe Hughes, who taught for some years at Westminster Seminary, and James I. Packer, who was the executive director, we would call it, of Latimer House, one of the libraries at Cambridge University, were what we would call low church Anglicans. They didn't believe in a high church worship service or a high church form of church government, and yet they remained within the Anglican community here in the later part of the 20th century. Well, Robinson's followers, he didn't go along, but Robinson's followers then sailed on the Mayflower for Virginia. It was only by mistake that they landed at Plymouth Rock. They didn't land in Virginia, even though they designed to land there. They were several hundred miles too far north, which gave them a tough winter to go through and a tough place to start their colony. But they started their colony there and thus became the first independent congregation in America. 10 years later, the Massachusetts Bay Colony was first established at Salem, Massachusetts, and then at Boston. By the way, these were non-separatist Puritans. They wanted to have a purified Anglican church, but they wanted to purify it from within. The charter they took with them from England allowed them to set up a purified Church of England in the colony that they would establish. And, of course, they had a patent or a right to set up a colony and to claim certain amount of land for the King of England, and they were then to establish a colony in which they could have a freedom of worship for themselves according to their ideas, what we would call a purified Church of England, a Calvinist, and certainly a far more spiritual Church of England than what they had left in England. Nevertheless, they were considered themselves still to be non-separatist in that they did not want to separate from the Church of England. Well, during the Commonwealth, the Independents set up the first missionary society, which was chartered by the Long Parliament in 1649. And so you have beginning then among the Puritans and the Independents the idea of foreign missions, something that was a very important development in the ideas of the Reformation. And what we're looking at, of course, here in England at this time are the results of the Reformation. And that was adopted, I think I said, in 1649 by the Long Parliament. Even toward the end of the Commonwealth, in the late 1650s, you had an independent statement of faith and order. And that met at the Savoy Palace. There was a group of independents who met in the Savoy Palace in London. And therefore, it is called the Savoy Declaration. And it's interesting because it's the Westminster Confession minus the ecclesiology, the doctrine of the church. It called for not a Presbyterian church government, but advisory councils. And yet it carried on a covenant theology. It carried on a very reformed, a Calvinistic theology, a very spiritual theology, as the Westminster Confession does. And so the Savoy Declaration became, for many Congregationalists, the confession of faith, which is held by some reformed Congregationalist groups here in the United States today. There are some Congregationalist groups that are not very Calvinist and not very conservative, of course, but there are also something like the Four C's, I think they call it. Boy, and I'm going to have trouble with the name. It's the Conservative Calvinist or Congregationalist Union of Churches, and they generally call their what we would think of as a presbytery or classes a conference. It does not have real authority. It has advisory council authority and so on. And so the Congregationalists continued and grew in their ideas and actually grew in their ability to carry on their ideas because of the discoveries of North America and their ability then to move here with some of their ideas. And so the early United States or the early colonies that eventually became the United States were often colonized by dissenters from the Church of England of one kind or another. We have to turn now in our discussion of groups that grew up to the Baptist. In 1606, John Smyth, a Congregationalist, took his congregation to Amsterdam. He and the whole congregation moved to Amsterdam because, of course, of the persecution that they received from the Anglican Church and the government in England. In 1609, he came to the conclusion that Anglican baptism, because it was, first of all, baptism by the wrong people, but it was also infant baptism, was wrong. And he believing in believer's baptism, he rebaptized himself and his congregation. Now, this is the beginning of modern baptism. The Anabaptists earlier on in Switzerland at the time of the Reformation and their followers around the rest of Europe, the Anabaptists, the Mennonites today, the Amish people, the Hutterites, and so on, had somewhat the same ideas, but we are not to connect them as though the English Baptists came out of those Anabaptist groups. No, the English Baptists are a separate group of people that arose in England during this period of rebellion and reformation in England. Well, anyway, he died in 1612, still seeking rebaptism for himself by someone else. He realized that baptizing himself was not the best idea. But anyway, he was an independent, and he started the Baptist movement as we have come to know it in among the English people, although he did that in the Netherlands. Now, following that, there was a man by the name of Thomas Helwys, who began the First Baptist Church in England in 1620. It was outside of London. It, however, was not Calvinist. It was Arminian in its view of the application of redemption. And, of course, it was adult Baptist. Now, what's interesting is that it grew in spite of persecution. And from this point on, we have to divide the Baptists into two groups. There are the general Baptists who believe in a general view of the atonement, namely that Jesus died for everyone. And there were particular Baptists who believed in a limited atonement. There were also some Baptists about this time who came up with the idea of Seventh-day Sabbatarianism. In general, they were very strict Bible believers, having a less than covenantal or overall view of the Bible, but picking certain texts out of the Bible they came up with their ideas. They began to first push immersion in 1640. By 1642, some of the Baptist churches has adopted immersion, and by 1644, single immersion became the preferred method of baptism among the Baptists, the English Baptists, which is in contrast to triple immersion, those who would dip a person three times. And so the Baptist movement began to grow in England, and the particular Baptists were generally more successful. There were more of them, and by 1689, they held an advisory meeting. Of course, they were independents in their view of church government, and so they held an independent view or an advisory view of the assemblies of the leaders of the church. They met, as I say, 1689, and adopted the Savoy Declaration, the Westminster Confession without the ecclesiology of it. This Baptist version of the Westminster Confession, by the way, was later adopted by the American Baptist, and it is it's called the Philadelphia Confession here. It's very similar to the Savoy Declaration. Well, the general Baptists became weaker. Their theology, of course, of a universal atonement in contrast to that of a particular atonement only for the elect. And during the 18th century, many of the general Baptists became Socinians. That is, they also denied the Trinity. And there is to this day a small Unitarian group of general Baptists who are also Socinians in England. Well, with that, we're going to have to close this lecture and go on with some more Orthodox groups in the next lecture.
This lecture is copyrighted by Reformation Christian Ministries, the parent organization of Reformation International Theological Seminary and Reformation International College. This audio lecture is protected under international copyright law and is not to be copied, distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. You may contact Reformation Christian Ministries through our website at www.reformation.edu. Reformation is spelled REFORMATION. By email, you can also contact us at president@reformation.edu. By phone in the U.S., you can reach us at 772-571-8030. By fax in the U.S., you can reach us at 772-571-8010. Or by writing to Reformation Christian Ministries, 13950 122 Street, Fellsmere, Florida, 32948 in the USA.